Today, in extraordinary timing, a day out from a federal election, we mark the death of Australia's 23rd Prime Minister, Robert James Lee Hawke. This is a Please Explain Extra. I'm Tory Maguire.
As a builder's labourer, I worked as a labourer on the chain gang and the abattoirs, and that's where I've, in a sense, felt happy.
I've said for a long time that if I went into Parliament, being the sort of person I am and thinking that I have certain capacities, I would try for the top position.
I tend, I think, occasionally to take too much refuge in having a drink. And I think that's helped me, but on occasions I've taken that refuge too much.
I've made no attempt to hide my character.
Do you feel like you're attractive to women?
I don't think about it.
Yeah.
By 1990, no Australian child will be living in poverty.
I tell you what, any boss who sacks anyone for not turning up today is a bum.
Then every Australian, from newborn babe to Prime Minister, can share in the cheapest, simplest and fairest health insurance scheme Australia's ever had, Medicare.
This is a new life, a new love, creating the greatest amount of happiness and prosperity and security that you can for your country. That's what your responsibility
thank
is.
Thank you for the wonderful Christmas. 10 or 11 years.
Thank you.
Australia, Bob.
Congratulations, sir.
We are you, Bob.
Keating polled 5 votes ahead of Bob Hawke, 56 to 51.
I just love Australia, and I love Australians. I mean, I love them passionately, and for a fair bit of the time, and a lot of them, they've reciprocated, not with a constancy. The measure changes, but I think we're still basically good mates.
Tony Wright is a senior writer and associate editor of The Age. Can you please tell me about the first time you encountered Robert Hawke?
Well, I sort of ran into him a few times because I was at the Border Morning Mail in Albury in the late 70s, early 80s, and he would come up to the Clyde Cameron Training College for trade unions. And those were his drinking days, and he would be a fellow well met those days. But really, I guess the first time I got to know him properly was when he became Prime Minister. He would come to Albury with his retinue of press gallery legends. And of course, I was just a fairly new journalist. I've been a journalist since 1970, but I was still a country kid. And he would turn up with Barry Cassidy as his press secretary. Barry Cassidy, by the way, had started at the Border Morning Mail some years before doing a cadetship. And along the way, I'd shared a house with a fellow named Jeff Walsh, who became another press secretary to Bob Hawke early, and then later on chief of staff and so forth. So I had a bit of an idea of those around him. But at the very first big press conference he held in Albury, I felt very intimidated. I was a local journo. And all these press gallery types had flown in from Canberra and were milling about, and I just couldn't imagine getting the chance to ask a question. And Bob Hawke said, you blokes from Canberra, you can back off and give the locals a go. And so I got to ask a couple of questions, and I felt 10 feet tall, and I've never forgotten it. Years later, of course, I was in Canberra, flying around the world and around the country with Bob Hawke myself as somebody from the press gallery. But that touch he had, that sort of knowledge, that knowing whatever it was within him, just knew that this was the right thing to do. That common touch came through with everything he did. And it continued right to the end of his life, really. You would often see him surrounded by people, even in his 80s, particularly women who just wanted to reach out and touch him. And he knew it too.
and enjoyed it.
A few years ago, I was in Western Sydney, and I think it was a book launch or something rather, and Hawkey turned up, and he was surrounded by particularly women who wanted to do selfies with him and touch him and all those sort of things. And I said, "G'day, Bob, how are you going?" He said, "Nah, mate, I've still got it."
He certainly did, and the timing of his death, just so close to the election on Saturday. It's only about 12 hours since news broke that he died at home with his wife and family around him. It's been quite an extraordinary reaction from across the country. Bob Hawke meant different things to different generations, didn't he? I mean, to my generation, Bob Hawke was kind of the most towering public figure of my childhood. And for many in my generation, you know, we grew up under his leadership where Australia had an enormous sense of confidence and we were given an enormous sense of confidence. But for my parents' generation, he really changed everything, didn't he?
Well, he and Paul Keating were, as you say, towering figures. The interesting thing about Bob Hawke in a sort of personal sense was that he wasn't large. He was quite a small bloke in stature, but he will be remembered and always was known as this, as you say, towering figure because of his effect on Australian life, Australian economy, Australian government, and the way Australia saw itself. I think when Bob Hawke came in 1983 as leader, the Labor Party had gone through a pretty traumatic time following the loss of power by Gough Whitlam back in 1975. He restored confidence not only to his party, but by then dragging in big business, small business, the unions, putting them together in a room and creating this thing called an accord. That was one of the first things he did. And that, I think, gave a sense of who this bloke was and how he could understand what was needed. And what was needed was to bring this country back together. He was known as the consensus prime minister, and he was. A lot of people who I've spoken to who sat in cabinet rooms with him, he would, instead of impose his own view on the room, he would allow all the ministers to have their say, to argue their bit, and then gradually, he would prompt them to reach a consensus opinion, a consensus on policy or whatever was being discussed. And then he would take that out, he would make it his own and he would sell it because he was a consummate salesman. And behind him, of course, he had Paul Keating, the economics man.
It takes an enormous amount of confidence, doesn't it, Tony, in your own self to be able to bring people along like that and to listen to different people's opinions and nudge people towards a consensus.
Hawke was given immense confidence almost from birth. His mother told of when she had this child opening the Bible because they were a preacher family. His father was a preacher. His mother was a very strong Christian. And she opened the Bible, and I wish I could tell you right this moment at which page it was supposed to have fallen open, but the words in there were something like, a child is born unto you and he will be a prince. He will be a leader. And so she instilled this belief in Bob Hawke, spoiled him rotten, of course, that he was going to be a man of greatness. And then when he was a young man, he had a motorcycle accident. It very nearly killed him. He was in a coma for a long time. And when he came out, I think it brought things together for him. He knew that he had to do something with his life. And so this confidence that was built into him since childhood came out in the way he then went on to become the ACTU leader who could solve very big industrial problems almost by turning up, this big white knight who would turn up, or little white knight. but having been spoiled rotten, he made use of all the vices as well. He was a drinker. He was a womanizer. Mm-hmm. He was vain. He you know, wasn't much of a father in the early days, even though he was father of the year one time, and Hazel, his wife, could hardly believe it, and neither could the country. But he was always forgiven, it seems. He was forgiven and forgiven because he had this intellect and this common touch and this ability to just reach out and bring people together and bring them to an understanding of where things ought to go.
This nation that we call Australia today could hardly have started under more difficult or more doubtful circumstances. And yet 200 years later, as a result of our forebears and what we've done ourselves, we now have a strong, proud, free, independent nation.
It's a very uncommon combination of traits in a human being to be filled with this sense of destiny and that I shall do great things, but also to be able to keep your human empathy and common touch. I mean, we're very familiar with lots of politicians who have that strong sense of destiny, but they haven't been able to maintain that ability to really be in touch with what people in Australia need, do they?
Yeah, it's a very interesting combination because, of course, he was as vain as anybody could imagine. He had a huge ego, but somehow or other he could build that into something else that people would grab hold of. And it's very difficult to quite define Bob Hawke because he was all of these things. I mean, he would gamble the family fortune away. He would spend long nights in casinos. He would berate people. He would sit around the pool naked until Paul Keating once said, "Oh, for God's sake, Bob, we've seen it all before. Put it away." yet you would think this combination of vanity and quite a short temper from time to time would put you off, but it never did. Mm. It never did. These sort of people are incredibly rare. I think Bill Clinton had this sort of thing at his height. He could enter a room and make everyone feel that they belonged and that they were important to him. And Bob Hawke had that.
Can we talk a bit about the ways in which he actually, not necessarily changed Australia, but led Australia through a period of great change? One of the things that has been talked about a lot in the 12 hours since we found out that he died was that Bob Hawke had zero tolerance for any kind of racism or discrimination and really stuck to that and stuck to his guns both publicly and privately. He did extraordinary work trying to undermine the apartheid movement in South Africa. He famously made that offer to Chinese students who were here after the Tiananmen massacre to stay. That was quite that kind of leadership at that time in Australia was crucial, wasn't it?
Well, yes, he was able to be in touch with the human side of us all and of himself, and I think perhaps that does go back to his religious upbringing from his parents, and by the fact that he was a pretty knockabout sort of fellow. He would move in all sorts of circles, and thus bigotry and racial prejudice and all the rest of it went out the door. But his work and that of Malcolm Fraser against apartheid in South Africa remains world-leading, actually. In fact, I remember that they used to argue later on about who was more important in releasing Mandela. In fact, I think they came to a consensus later on that they were equally important. But at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meetings, Bob Hawke and earlier Fraser stood out, standing up against the South African regime, standing up against Maggie Thatcher, and those who were reactionaries and didn't want apartheid to quite end. He was quite vociferous about it. And I recall once in the 1990 election, he had the plane that we were all travelling on, the old VIP plane, land in Alice Springs for no reason that we could imagine. But the facts were that Mandela had just been released, and he had asked to phone Bob Hawke and thank him for his work. as it happened, that night the phones wouldn't connect, and Bob Hawke ended up going back to his room in a huge sulk because the phone call had gone through to Gareth Evans and not to him. But look, he was a one-off during that period to allow Vietnamese boat people to settle in Australia, to stand absolutely against Australia's White Australia past, and all those sort of things were very important to Australia and Australians still.
Another thing about him that has become so much a part of the way we think of Bob Hawke was his willingness to publicly embrace and acknowledge his own failings and his own frailty, and be willing to cry in public about things that are happening in his family and his failures.
I understand people have been hurt, and hurt particularly unfairly. If I see a child being hurt, I mean, my emotions come up. That's the thing that hurts me, hurt.
You don't cease to be a husband. You don't cease to be a father.
In Australia at that time, men really weren't expected to cry in public, were they?
No, they weren't. And everyone who was there can recall him crying about his family, the fact that a daughter had become a heroin addict. I think just about any father would cry, but he was the Prime Minister, and he was there in the spotlight, and I think that reached a lot of people's hearts because a lot of people understood what it was to have not only had a near tragedy in your own family, but have the guilt, I guess, that you might have had something to do with it because you were a pretty hopeless father. He would admit that later on, and at that time. Then, of course, you mentioned the moment after Tiananmen Square. He had the ability to visualise what was going on in the lives of people quite often very distant to him, and those people who were crushed to death on Tiananmen Square obviously got into his heart.
Thousands have been killed and injured, victims of a leadership that seems determined to hang on to the reins of power at any cost. Foot soldiers went through the square bayoneting or shooting anybody who was still alive. They had orders that nobody in the square be spared.
A lot of his colleagues were urging him not to reach out and say all the students who were in Australia could stay, but he just decided to do it, and I think it worked for him. This is the thing about Hawke. He was perceived to live with his heart on his sleeve, and he was perceived to have the weaknesses that all the rest of us have and make the best of it. Now, some of that was showbiz and some of it wasn't. You would be hard-pressed to know what was showbiz and what wasn't because he was a very complex character, and people could really, really dislike him up close when things went wrong. I mean, Paul Keating was one of those. That year when Paul Keating went for Bob Hawke's leadership, failed the first time, and then undermined him and undermined him and undermined him, and finally, in late December 1991, he won against Bob Hawke. And there was a lot of hatred there. There really was. A lot of dislike. But Hawke managed to weather that too. It took some years, and Keating and he sat together only last week in favour of a new Labor government. They wanted Bill Shorten to win. Mm. So they were prepared to put all those things behind them, and I think they probably had as the years had gone by anyway. But that was a big turnaround. For those who were there during that period, you can't imagine the bitterness. It was very deep indeed. And I got invited to Bob Hawke's last party at the lodge. It was New Year's Eve, 1991, 92. as it turned over. And he'd asked to stay in the lodge until he could have that last wingding, that last fling.
Did anyone end up in the pool?
No, it was raining, and it was a pretty sad sort of show, actually. Mm. Hardly any of his former ministers or colleagues turned up. A few friends, a few of his staff, people from the racing community, because, of course, horse racing was part of Bob Hawke, turned up. But he gave a pretty white-hot speech, to the point where Hazel pushed him off the stage and said, Bob, I'll take it from here.
Right.
And you could feel the disappointment that he couldn't bear the idea that he'd somehow or other lost to this fellow Keating. But, of course, he'd brought a lot of it on himself, you know, the Kirribilli deal and all that sort of thing that he'd he'd broken the faith. Of course, he would say that Keating had broken the faith. But, you know, you can go back through that again and again and again, and it all sort of disappears into the mist, because as you said, the towering figure of Bob Hawke just comes through, and that's how we'll remember him.
So just finally, Tony, today I think it's a common refrain right across the country that they don't make them like they used to. As we go to the ballot box tomorrow and people are making up their minds about whether to vote for Scott Morrison or Bill Shorten, they suffer in their comparison, don't they, to a leader of this stature?
Yes, they do. Of course, we've changed too. Australia was ready for a Bob Hawke. Australia was ready for a Paul Keating. Australia was ready for a John Howard, for that matter. And we sort of expected to keep prime ministers and governments for some time, except, of course, that period with Gough Whitlam previously. What has happened in Australia in this new connected, webbed world in which we live, where everything happens at lightning speed, even the change of leaders, has changed us. And so we look back almost mistily, I suppose, at that period where we had a prime minister and a treasurer who could run a country for all but a decade, and then more as Keating took over. And we had, you know, John Howard do pretty much the same thing. Now we've had all this cascade of prime ministers. It may be that we're ready again for somebody to come to the top and to meet the expectations and the requirements of a modern nation. I don't know whether it'll happen, but it certainly happened in 1983 when Bob Hawke arrived.
Tony, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
We'll be doing a Please Explain Extra on election night, so make sure you subscribe to the podcast to get an alert when it drops. Thanks for listening. I'm Tori.
My bloody terminal is getting his tunes mixed up. Once a jolly swagman camped by the billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree, and he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You come a waltzing Matilda with me. Oh, sing Matilda, waltzing Matilda. You come a waltzing Matilda with me. And he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You come a waltzing Matilda.